am so glad that you have tuned into this episode, because this is episode number 78. That's the year I graduated high school, and it's also the year of one of the biggest snowstorms to ever hit the United States, and I can say I was there. We just dug out of a massive winter storm here in the Midwest, and yours truly injured his back shoveling a lot of wet snow. I mean, heavy snow. You know, I was out cleaning out the ice and snow off, I think, three different vehicles in the driveway for the girls. And yeah, it's official. I am getting older. So if you, if you're getting this podcast a little bit late, let me just kind of tell you why. I ended up going to the chiropractor after literally having to crawl up the stairs in our house on my hands and knees. Yeah, nobody saw me. But that's when I knew I was going to need a little help, more help than just, you know, taking a few ibuprofen and calling it a day. You know, when I was a kid, my Uncle Bill, he used to always say to me, you know, you just wait till you get older, because it ain't for sissies. Boy, was he right. You know, I'd have felt a little better about hurting my back, you know, if it was more like because I did it, you know, dragging out like a 200-inch buck, or maybe I was lifting weights. But no, I was shoveling that white fluffy stuff that falls out of the sky. But at least it wasn't from getting out of bed wrong. I hear so many guys say, you know, when you get older, you don't hurt yourself doing big things. You do it like doing small stuff, tripping over something or falling out of bed, whatever. But I used to love it. When I was a kid and the snow would fall down, I mean, I just thought it was incredible. I couldn't wait to get out there and be sled riding, you know, get the hot chocolate. And I don't feel so much that way now. I actually really dread it. Stacy was really pumped when she saw this storm coming. She's like, hey, we can get a fire going and make hot chocolate. And all I can think about is, yeah, and I'm going to be the guy that's going to be out there shoveling all this stuff. But anyhow, I lived through it. I went to the chiropractor this morning, and I'll go again tomorrow. I got to fly to Florida on Thursday night, as I got to speak down there for, I get to speak down there for a men's retreat Friday and Saturday. But anyhow, when I was a kid, I was telling you that I used to love, you know, the snow. And we lived probably about 100 yards from one of the best sled riding hills in Pennsylvania. I mean, really, it was an awesome hill. It's right where I grew up, in a little town of Rocky Grove. And it was a long, flat hill that flattened out at the bottom where the elementary school where I attended, like from first to sixth grade, was located. And we used to pour water down the hill, you know, at the very top. And we poured over the snow, you know, bucket after bucket, because it would turn that snow into ice. And then the hill was crazy fast. You couldn't walk up it. But going down, I mean, it was like supersonic sled riding. It was awesome. And I'm sure today's parents, you know, they probably have something to say about that. But this was the baby boomers generation. That's what I grew up in. So if you could dream it up, you're probably going to do it. And yes, it did make it faster, but you would get going so fast that you could not slow down. And the problem was, you know, the wall of the school wasn't that far after you got to the very bottom. I mean, it was maybe 25 yards, but when you're on ice, you can't get stopped. And I actually, one time I got going so fast that I ran head first into that concrete wall. I broke my nose. I probably got a concussion. But back then, you know, you just kind of, you know, shook it off, get back to the top of the hill and do it again. But now you had an awesome story to tell. And, you know, the stories and the memories that we made back then are ones that, you know, we keep until the day we die. If any of you guys that used to hang out with me in the Grove, and if you listen to this, you know exactly what I'm talking about. We had two more places we used to sled ride on that same street, actually, but across the road. One was called the Cowpath, and it was a steep, I mean steep, hill at the top. And there was a big jump you would go off of, and you'd get airborne, and then you'd, probably how I hurt my back originally, to be honest with you. And then there was another one, but it was down around the corner. We called it the Torture Trail. And it was really twisty and windy. But like I said, if you could dream it up, you were doing it. I mean, it was just, what a great time to be alive. But this was during the blizzard of 78. And let's see, I would have been 18, because I had just graduated high school. And it was the opening day of buck season back in the hills of Pennsylvania. And Dad and I were wearing probably every bit of long underwear that we owned. I mean, the wind chill was terrible as well. And we had those felt pack boots. If you can remember those things, they probably weigh like 20 pounds each. And we had like a Wonder Bread wrapper around each foot to try to keep our feet dry. And I wish I'd have had someone who knew better back then, you know, ask me that question. You know, so how's that working for you? Because if you know, you know. It just made your feet, you know, just sweat and smell really, really bad. But it's all we knew. But the area where we were headed to hunt on opening day was plowed, mostly. But Dad, you know, I had an El Camino back then, and he put a couple of extra 50-pound sandbags in the back of that El Camino to get better traction. It had, I'm trying to remember, we had a posit track rear end in that, but it really did help, whether you had a load of wood or whether you put extra sandbags or whatever in the back, especially if you got into deep snow. You know, going out into that nightmare, Dad packs, you know, extra food for us. He packs extra water and blankets, you know, just in case we get stuck or maybe have to ask for help. You know, Dad grew up, he came out of that World War II generation, and it's just, they were always prepared. So when we arrived at the location, we turned down this dirt road where you could barely make out that it was a road. And the only way you could tell is that a few pickup trucks had already gone down the road and down this real steep hill, and they had, you know, left tire tracks so we could see where to drive. And as we got going down, we didn't want to go down the steepest part of that hill, so we tried to park somewhat off the road right before you hit this big hill, because we didn't want to have to go down that and have to come back up again with this snow. Not in, you know, in a two-wheel drive, that the posit track or end vehicle. So we get out, we get all of our stuff together, and we step off the road and into the snow entering the woods. And no kidding, the snow was up to our thighs. It was all of 3 feet deep. And because of that, we only went into the woods maybe 70 yards. And we, you know, back then you kind of got to the base of a big tree, and you would kind of kick the snow away and just kind of clear it out so you'd have a place to stand. And we waited for first light. We'd done this, you know, ever since I think 13 was my first year to hunt. And about 10 minutes after it got light, that first rifle shot of the morning was right up above us, maybe 150 yards, just on the other side of the road. And, you know, I kept watching like you do. When you hear a gunshot that close, you know, you're really paying attention. About 15 seconds later, here comes this deer busting across the road as hard as it could in this deep snow. And it was going to run broadside right to us at about 20 yards. And the snow was so deep that the deer really couldn't run. It was more like just kind of leaping, almost like a mule deer trying to get through this snow as it was so deep, and it just couldn't get up to speed. And the deer, if as we were watching it, you could see that the hindquarters were red, and this other hunter had made a bad shot. He'd wounded it. So I pull my .30-06 up ready to fire, and Dad sees me do this, and he's yelling, "Brent, don't shoot, it's a doe." Dad had been focused on that bleeding area on the back of the deer to see, you know, how bad was this deer wounded. But I was sure I had seen antlers before I pulled the trigger. And before you could count to one, boom, you know, the deer drops in its tracks. And I immediately went over to this thing. It had tipped over in the snow. And the snow was so deep that the head of that deer was totally in the snow. You couldn't see it at all. And as we approached this deer, Dad keeps saying to me, Brent, I'm sure that was a doe. He's like, oh, and he's touching his forehead. You know, what are we going to do? And as I lifted this deer's head out of the snow, there wasn't an antler on the right side. And I'm instantly freaking out because I didn't want to get a citation and I didn't want to disappoint my dad. And as the left side of that head came out of the snow, a heavy 4-point rack popped up. And somehow it had lost an antler. I'm probably in a fight or something earlier that season during the rut. But I can remember feeling like, oh no, what's my dad going to think about me if I shot a doe? You know, as I was growing and wanting to be able to brag about stuff, well, what do? You know, yeah, I shot a doe during buck season and I got a citation, you know, whatever. And I was afraid that Dad was going to be disappointed in me. But as soon as I pulled that head out of the snow, I could see the feeling of pride. You know, he realized that I was paying attention, that I'd gotten it right. So we load this thing up. We drag it. I mean, what a trail to try to get this thing back to the El Camino. And, you know, it's a good thing we actually had extra weight along with that deer. in the back of the El Camino, because we ended up needing all the traction we could get, because we ended up having to go down that. We couldn't get turned around. We had to go down this big hill and just, you know, pumping the brakes, because you didn't have anti-lock brakes back then. And luckily, we were able to kind of, we didn't have GPS, but we found our way out of another way. We didn't have to go up as steep of a hill. But, you know, we didn't know what that new way out was going to look like. But the good news was that we were prepared, you know, even if we had gotten stuck, because we had all the other supplies with us. So let's fast forward about 15 years. Dad and I were hunting in another spot, probably about 8 to 10 miles from that location. And it was a real wet snow that morning, and we were pretty wet. And we decided to, you know, go back to the truck. Hey, let's go back, get some sandwiches, maybe a change of clothes. You know, we put our gloves up on the dash, and we're going to, you know, heat them up there and try to thaw everything out. And I had had a tree climber with me on my back that morning as well. So as we're coming back, I've got that tree climber. I've got my OT6 over my shoulder. And as we get to my truck, another pickup truck pulls up on this snowy road, and I'm taking my rifle off, and the guy starts talking to me, and he asked me if we'd seen any bear tracks. You know, with all my gear on, including that climbing stand, you know, it was kind of bulky and heavy to kind of, you know, have a conversation. So I just kind of took my rifle off, and I turned around, and I leaned it against the tailgate, and I point to this guy in the direction we'd seen the bear tracks. You just guessed it. He was a game commissioner. And he was a part-timer. And he looked just like Barney Fife. If you could, oh, Andy, what are we going to do? I mean, he looked just like this guy. He immediately gets out of his truck, and he told me to go stand and wait over by the front of my truck. He gets back in his truck. You know, my dad's looking at me like, oh, great. We get back around the front of the truck. This guy gets on his radio because he has to call for help. He can't write the ticket up himself. He was only a part-time guy. So he has to wait for his boss to get there. And what's funny now is, this guy was a chiropractor for his real job, where I just was this morning, and because of a snowstorm, I'd hurt my back. So this guy, I don't even remember, I must have had a sore back or something, but he tells me to lay down on the ground, and he gives me some exercises to do for my back while I'm waiting for this guy to get here to write me up a ticket. For real. You know, I don't know, maybe he thought I was going to offset the cost of the ticket. But it's just another one of those really crazy stories. Some stories you have are great stories, and some are like, you got to be kidding me. But now let's fast forward about 20 years. And it was January 24th, 2013, and I have this logged at 8:20 p.m. I was in Bangor, Maine. I was at an airport. I had just landed there, and we had some guys, my buddy Wade and I had some guys picking us up to drive us up into Canada to speak for this nationally televised men's event that was going to be going on. And as we're getting ready to board this flight, it's late, or we're getting ready to leave to get in this car. It's one of those things, you know, it's late at night, we have to get going. There's no more flights going out that night. And I get this phone call, and it's my sister on the other end of the line, and she says, Brent, Mom and Dad have been in a terrible car accident. Mom is having an MRI done right now on her leg, and Dad was just life-flighted to Tampa, which is where I'm going to be speaking this weekend. How strange is this? He was life-flighted because he was having bleeding on the brain. You know, it's funny. I'm reading through this right now, and I didn't know what I was going to talk about. And as I'm sitting here going through all this, it just lets me know that God is reminding me that he's been with me all these years. You'll get it in a second. So yeah, he's been life-flighted to Tampa. Now, we had just arrived in Bangor, Maine, an hour before, and we're headed into Canada for this men's ministry conference. And like I said, there's no flights going out that evening. There's nothing I can do. And I had to choose. You know, either I try to catch a bus and get to Boston to try to get a flight out sometime later the next afternoon. Or I go into Canada, speak for that Saturday morning event, and get back to Bangor and fly out in the afternoon. One of the hardest decisions I ever had to make. And I knew what my father would say. He would say, Brent, there's nothing you can do for me right now. Keep your commitments, trust God, and go and do what you're called to do. Even though... And even though I knew what the right thing to do was, it was one of the most difficult decisions of my entire life, because I wanted to be with my dad, and my dad is 1,500 miles away. So I spent the next 6 hours. I think we got into, it was about maybe 11 o'clock, I think, at night when we get to where we're headed. And I kept waiting for my sister to call and give me an update. I can't sleep. You know, I'm on my knees at the end of my bed, and she's not calling, because there was nothing to share yet. She probably thought I was trying to get some sleep. But when the call came, it wasn't good. And she said, I think it was around 3 or 4 in the morning, she said, Brent, they can't get the bleeding stopped, and they're going to have to do emergency surgery on him within the hour. So what had happened was, there was a young 16-year-old girl who had been texting on her phone. Mom and dad were sitting at a traffic light, and she wasn't looking up, and she hit them doing almost 60 miles an hour. And my dad, you know that little hand thing when you reach up to grab a hold of, he had hit that with his head, and then there was a car in front of them that they were pushed into, and then the girl hit him again. So that's what caused all this trauma to my father's head. And you know, when she gets that call to me and tells me they're going to have to do this emergency surgery, you know, my mind has already been racing, and now it's kicking into overdrive. And, you know, I'm just like, God, you know, right now I'm feeling out of control. There is nothing I can do to fix this situation. This is literally my conversation with God. I'm saying, you know, Dad is totally in your hands, and I am trusting you and asking you for your will to be done. And I picked up, you know, not knowing what to do, I needed to do something. So I pick up a piece of paper and I begin to write my father a letter. Whether he'll ever see it again or not, I had no idea. I just needed to do it. And these are the words, I still have it. It's so funny that I came across this now. And this is episode 78, and we're talking about the blizzard of 78. And here we are going back to Tampa where all this had happened. And I said in this letter, Dad, I hope you can hear me. I love you more than you'll ever know. I wish so bad I could be with you and be there right now. I know you're scared and worried, and God knows that too. I also know that God never leaves us or forsakes us. He sticks closer than a brother. Dad, you're in good hands, the hands that created everything there is, and I'm so glad He made you. You are the best father in the world. Dad, when David was afraid, he cried out to God, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in paths of righteousness for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Dad, everything's going to be okay no matter what, as it's all in the Father's hands. I love you, and I will see you soon. And like we always say to each other, Dad, I love you more than you'll ever know. Your son, Brent. Dad would end up passing away months later. And I would be there to sing him songs and tell him stories when he did pass, until he took his final breath. He had had a massive stroke. But he prepared me my whole life for difficult circumstances. And now it was my turn to walk with him, you know, through these trials. And there's a verse that I want to share with you guys that I've come to hold on to in difficult circumstances, and it has seen me through the toughest times. I love this. These are Paul's words. And he says, because of the extravagance of those revelations, and so I wouldn't get a big head, I was given the gift of a handicap to keep me in constant touch with my limitations. Satan's angel did his best to get me down. What he did, in fact, was push me to my knees. No danger then of walking around high and mighty. At first, I didn't think of it as a gift, and I begged God to remove it. 3 times I did that, and then He told me, my grace is enough. It's all you need. My strength comes into its own in your weakness. Once I heard that, I was glad to let it happen. I quit focusing on the handicap and begin appreciating the gift. It was a case of Christ's strength moving in on my weakness. Now I take limitations in stride and with good cheer. These limitations that cut me down to size, abuse, accidents, opposition, bad breaks. I just let Christ take over. And so the weaker I get, the stronger I become. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 12, 7 through 10 from the Message. And as I was doing this, I came across a quote from Helen Keller. If you can remember, you know, many, many years when she grew up, she was blind. And she penned this. I love this. She says, "Death is no more than passing from one room into another. But there's a difference for me, you know, because in that other room, I shall be able to see." In Dad's final days, he had a massive stroke. He could no longer communicate, and for all we know, he couldn't see, as there was no response when we moved things back and forth in front of his eyes. But when he took his final breath, Dad was able to see something that we could no longer dream or imagine, for he was in the presence of the one who created everything there is. This weekend, you know, we were hit with a huge snowstorm here in the Midwest. You know, the schools and businesses were closed. You know, grocery store shelves got empty really fast, and everyone was stocking up for what they were about to face. They were preparing to be prepared. My dad was prepared back in the blizzard of 78, and he was prepared when the accident happened. That was in 2013. Dad knew Jesus, and he had taught his children to know Jesus as well. Dad left a legacy of faith and trusting in God, no matter what. Guys, 2025 promises to be a year that I'm sure is going to hold a lot of unknowns. If it's any crazier than 2024, we know it will. But one thing we can know is that the one who made it all put you in it for this time, for his purposes. So just know that no matter what gets thrown your way, you have what it takes. So let Christ take over and remember that in your weakness, he is made strong. We'll see you next time.